For all coming out this morning. Today I'm going to be talking about work that I completed with colleagues at the Harvard School of Public Health and other co-investigators in the EDSAFE trial that I'll be talking a bit about. And this was work that we did looking at the beliefs and behaviors of emergency department providers as relates to lethal means restriction as a method of suicide prevention. Better? Sorry. We have no disclosures, but I do want to acknowledge that funding for the project was from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the NIH through the EDSAFE study. So just by way of background, emergency departments treat a lot of suicidal patients. It's estimated that about 500,000 patients are seen each year for non-fatal self-inflicted injuries. And it's estimated that if you take all comers to EDs, from ankle sprains to chest pain to mental health complaints, that up to 11% of patients have some form of suicidal ideation. Rates for ED visits for suicidal ideation appear to be rising at the same time that mental health resources, both inpatient and outpatient, are becoming more scarce. And it's estimated that almost half of suicide victims visit an emergency department in the year before their death. And so I think all of this together suggests that these emergency department visits are an important opportunity for suicide prevention. For those not familiar with how ED care works, I wanted to just spend 1 minute sort of saying what we actually do so that you can have a sense of what's feasible. So usually patients, the suicidality among patients, it could be recognized because they come in with that as a chief complaint, certainly. In other cases, a provider might ask questions because of concerns about how the patient's acting or something they said, or many hospitals now have standard screening protocols where, for example, the nurse asks a certain number of questions to every patient. So when a patient is recognized at having some suicidal thoughts or behaviors, then usually the provider does a bit more of a risk assessment to decide if the patient needs a formal mental health evaluation. And if they are concerned, then really one of two things happens. At some hospitals, especially larger hospitals, there's usually some kind of on-site psychiatry or mental health professionals who are available to do those consults and further assessment and counseling. But in rural and smaller hospitals, often they have to call in someone from off-site. And this is an issue because it leads to delays in patient care, which is something that emergency departments don't like and are with issues of crowding sort of fighting against. And so it just underscores that it's important that ED providers have at least some basic skills that they can do some of this themselves. Certainly a lot of patients are going to end up needing additional professional evaluation, but it would be great if we could avoid having to get a consult in every case, for example. And then lethal means restriction, for those of you not as familiar with this as a method of suicide prevention, is the idea that if you limit access to lethal means, such as firearms, during that period of vulnerability, you potentially can save lives, in that it's often an impulsive act. And there is some evidence that this might be a method that could be used by emergency department providers through asking about access to lethal means and then counseling patients and families about how to lock up firearms, lock up toxic medications, and so forth. So what do ED providers think and what do they do? Well, there hasn't been a lot of work in the area. It does, from the previous studies, most of which were surveys, looks like physicians and nurses ask or counsel about lethal means in less than or around half of cases of suicidal patients. We did a survey at one site of physicians and nurses about suicidal patients. We found that 50% figure about how often they say they ask about access to firearms. And again, this is specifically in cases of suicidal patients, not injury prevention in general. And 26% said that they thought means restriction wouldn't prevent suicides. And so in this study, we wanted to use a multi-site larger sample to explore in greater detail the beliefs and behaviors of ED providers with the idea that this could be a way to intervene and prevent suicide, but we've got to know sort of what's going on before we can design any of those interventions. So the EDSAFE trial is a multi-site study that's ongoing right now. It's funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, and it's at 8 emergency departments around the country. And it aims to test universal screening and a brief intervention for suicidal patients. But the study also includes a survey of providers at those 8 sites. The survey does have some questions about general care of suicidal patients, but today I'm going to be talking about the specific module that was related to lethal means restriction. So the survey itself was a confidential survey. It could be completed either online or on paper, and there were no incentives. Eligible participants were those who worked at least half-time in the participating EDs. We included physicians and nurses, and physicians were both attendings and resident physicians. And I should say that the eight sites, pretty much all of them are larger academic sites. And then data collection was about 2 to 3 months at each site, but it was staggered over about a 9-month period. So we collected some basic demographics as well as provider characteristics, such as how many suicidal patients they estimated that they treated per month. And then we had questions about their beliefs, specifically related to means restriction and whose responsibility it is to ask and counsel about lethal means. And then some questions about behavior, specifically about asking about firearms in particular scenarios. So here's what we found. We had 631 respondents with a 79% response rate. It was about half female and about half nurses, and predominantly white, non-Hispanic. Providers had been working in healthcare for about 8 years, excluding their time in training, and they estimated they cared for about 15 suicidal patients per month. So then we asked this question, which is trying to get at lethal means restriction. Each month in the U.S., over 1,000 people die by suicide using firearms. Had a firearm not been accessible to them, how many do you think would have found another way to kill themselves? It's impossible to know what the true answer is, but I think it's highly unlikely that all of them would have found another method when you look at studies of attempt survivors. And so that's what we were most interested in. And we found that 13% of nurses and about 5 to 6% of physicians said that every single one of these suicide victims would have found another way to kill themselves, even if a firearm hadn't been available, which I think expresses a degree of skepticism or perhaps ignorance about the idea of means restriction as being effective. So next we asked, well, whose responsibility do you think it is to ask about firearms and other lethal means? And then separately, whose responsibility is it to counsel patients and their families about lethal means? And people could answer more than one provider type, either ED nurses, ED physicians, psychiatrists, or social workers and mental health counselors. And I think a couple of things stand out. First, for both asking and counseling, most respondents thought that it was the job of a psychiatrist or a mental health counselor. But then when you look at the ED providers, for both asking and counseling, more people thought it was the job of the physician than the nurse. I think one of the difficulties in this area is it's not clearly defined whose job it is to do these things. And unfortunately, I think what happens is sometimes nobody asks and nobody counsels because everybody thinks someone else is doing it. And so it's interesting to see what sort of people think is going on. But I will say, though, that many of the at least screening protocols right now rely on nurses. And so it's I think there's a bit of a disconnect that people don't think it's the nurse's responsibility, and yet we're often asking nurses to do these things. So then this graph is the same questions, but it's the proportion who said that their own provider type should be doing it. So almost 60% of nurses said that they thought nurses should be asking about firearms. And I think what you can see here is that, especially for assessment, actually more physicians thought that they should be asking than nurses, which is sort of what we saw in the previous graph as well. And that for all provider types, more thought that they should be asking than counseling, which I think is not surprising if you've ever been in an ED environment and how busy it is, that the idea of sitting down to counsel someone is something that is often somewhat foreign to us. And we might be more resistant to that concept. So then in terms of behaviors, we asked, how often do you ask patients whether there are firearms at home in each of these situations? And there were 5 scenarios. So if the patient had been suicidal in the past month but was not currently suicidal, if they were suicidal today but said they didn't have a plan, if they were suicidal with a plan that didn't involve a firearm, if they were suicidal with a plan that did involve a firearm, or if they were in the ED after an overdose but they were no longer suicidal. And so what you can see here are the proportions who said that they often or almost always ask about firearms in those cases. The physicians included both attendings and residents because their responses didn't vary from each other. And I'd like to point out just a couple of things. First, really in all of the scenarios, more physicians than nurses said they often or almost always ask. These were the two scenarios that had the lowest proportion saying that they routinely ask. That is, when a patient had been suicidal but said they weren't now. Or, I think somewhat disturbingly, when a patient was actually in the ED after an apparent attempt but said they were no longer suicidal. Part of that may be related to the people thinking that that's a case where a mental health professional is involved, and so maybe they think someone else is doing it. We didn't get down to that level of detail in the question. But still, certainly that person who's overdosed is at risk for future suicide attempts, and you could be concerned about them. And then the case with the highest proportion was where a patient was suicidal with a plan that does involve a gun, which I think gets to the ED providers. Sometimes they're fairly concrete and focused on the task at hand. If you tell me you're going to shoot yourself, I'm going to ask if you have a gun. But I might not think about asking that in other kinds of scenarios. So then we wanted to look at factors associated with asking about firearms. And so we took as our outcome often or almost asking about firearms in all five of those scenarios, with the idea that those are the people who routinely are asking suicidal patients regardless of the particular scenario. And there were 103 providers who fit in this category. And then we looked at variables associated with this, including demographics, provider characteristics, such as years of work in healthcare. And then for beliefs, we looked at whether you thought your own provider type should be asking, whether that was associated with the behavior. And then if you thought that every single one of those firearm suicide victims would have died by another method. And we included in our final model all the variables that were significant in bivariate analysis. And we clustered all the models by study site to try to get rid of geographic differences. And what we found in the final model, it was also adjusted for gender, although gender was not significant in the final model. But older providers tended to more routinely ask, attending physicians as compared to nurses. And then the people who thought that it was their job type to be asking were the ones who were asking, which maybe isn't that surprising, but I think gets to that, again, if it's a concrete kind of job responsibility, people perhaps are more likely to do it. And I think underscores the importance of deciding who we think should be doing this and then training that group to do it, as opposed to just leaving it the way it is now, which is somewhat nebulous. In summary, I think we found, unfortunately, that there is some skepticism still among ED providers in terms of the effectiveness of means restriction and suicide prevention in general, and that often ED providers aren't asking about access to lethal means, perhaps except in the case when a patient has a specific firearm plan. But even in those cases, 10% of physicians said they hardly ever ask. Again, this could be because they think someone else is asking, but it's hard to know, and I think it's going to be important that we better define these kinds of care protocols. I think our results reinforce prior concerns about gaps in provider training as well as possible biases in treating mental health patients. And as I mentioned, I think they suggest that we perhaps are somewhat concrete. If it's our job, we do it. If it's the thing in front of us, we ask about it. And that perhaps at least behavior is linked to your beliefs about your job responsibilities. Some limitations just to acknowledge, we did rely on self-report, although it was a confidential survey. The providers at these 8 EDs may differ from those at others, especially smaller or rural hospitals. And we didn't adjust for other variables, such as whether the patient was going to be seeing a mental health professional. And in terms of where this is going, I work in an ED. I understand the realities of care there. I don't think it's reasonable to expect ED physicians or nurses to be doing lengthy assessments or lengthy counseling sessions with patients. It's just not going to happen. But at the same time, acknowledging the shortages in mental health resources, I do think that it's reasonable and important that we expect providers to be able to do brief risk assessments, which I think should include asking about access to lethal means. And I think it's going to be important that we better define who really should be doing this work so that we can appropriately train them and hopefully go on to prevent future attempts. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions. Yeah. Yeah.
What happens in urgent care settings? Do you have any information about these 24-hour pop-ups?
Of any scientific basis, but from my experience in care, I'm pretty sure if anyone said anything, they would send them to an ED, that they sort of bump it up to a higher level. Yeah.
Thank you.
Your whole study is based on the premise that it makes a difference whether doctors do this or not. Would you briefly summarize the evidence that age restriction matters?
Well, so I think there's there.
I think this is
going to be a great session because I think we're going to talk about that in a lot of different ways. I think means restriction, as a general concept, I think there is good evidence that that limiting access to lethal means can prevent death, and that, for example, on the flip side, having a firearm in the home is a risk factor for suicide, not because it makes you suicidal, but because it's accessible in a time of crisis. I think there isn't a lot of great evidence that emergency department interventions for means restriction go on to prevent suicides, and that's what I'm particularly interested in, is whether actually this is something we should be doing. I think before we start putting any interventions in EDs in place, we need more evidence that, in fact, this is a time period and this is the kind of provider who should be doing it. I think right now we're not even really asking about whether people have access. And I do think that understanding if a person has access to lethal means at home, that can influence your risk assessment of whether that patient is safe to be discharged or not. But I hope that answers your question. I think that there's good evidence in the general realm. I don't think there's a ton of evidence that ED-based interventions necessarily work, but there haven't been a lot of studies on it.
Can I just add a comment on that? There have been at least one study, I know, by David Brent in Pittsburgh, in which he talked about counseling of parents. Now, that is not exactly emergency department physicians, but he did counseling of parents who had an adolescent that was at risk for suicidal behavior in terms of removing some of the lethal means, specifically the firearms. And he did find that the parents who got counseled were much more likely to remove that lethal weapon, the firearm, than those who didn't get the counseling. So at least in that instance, that counseling made a difference for those parents removing that firearm. Now, the outcome is the next thing that you have to be looking at. And I don't remember exactly what he looked at, whether he looked, you know, longitudinally at the outcome in terms of whether a suicide or suicide attempt occurred. But just in regards to removing that method, removing that means, it did happen more so with the parents that got counseled.
And I think one of the things we've struggled with is on the adult end, how to translate that. Is it do we try to counsel family members? There's no parent there, and so figuring out what we do with adults, I think, is a little tricky.
For the patients that you're dealing with, and there's patients who have already tried to kill themselves, the people who were brought to the ER because there was a concern.
In this survey, we were just asking about, and this was all related to adult patients, but we were just asking if the patient was suicidal, not necessarily having been there for an attempt. So in the scenarios, for example, someone who said they'd been suicidal in the past month but wasn't presently, we didn't specify if they'd actually made an attempt or not. But that is a good point that, you know, that an attempt certainly should raise your awareness. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, it wasn't in your study, but I looked at the question of would an emergency physician think of referring to somebody they thought was appropriate? I know they're not conducting an assessment, but do they send the patient anywhere else, or is the patient just sent out of an emergency?
Well, so this is the usually someone's called in. Actually, we don't let a potentially suicidal patient be discharged until we feel comfortable that they're safe. So typically, if we're concerned, we would ask some kind of mental health professional to come do a more lengthy assessment and decide if the patient needs hospitalization or not. And that's one of the things we didn't really control for in this that might be explaining some of the behavior. But I think what's tricky is that I don't know that there's a lot of evidence that, for example, those mental health consultants are always asking about this either. Again, it gets to this idea like it's not. When I check their notes, do I always check to see that they ask the question? No. And so, you know, we assume they're asking, but they might not actually always be. Yeah, in the back.
Better understanding what's going on.
Yeah, I think, I can't speak specifically to what kind of training they get, but from my experience in care, typically they are very good about relaying whatever information they have. They, you know, even things like what they saw in the house or what the scene looked like or, you know, what family's around. And then on the flip side, at least physicians typically are trained to ask those questions to providers. Is a family member coming? Did you see pill bottles all over the place? That kind of thing. But I don't know what the specific, what the actual training guidelines are. Yeah. All right. Super. Thank you very much.